That's looking promising. An error occurred on Periscope. This is usually temporary. That's because...
Oh, dear. Stop reading error messages to people. They don't care.
They do. They want to know. What's broken, Chris Brogan?
They don't.
My name almost rhymes with that. Welcome to the Backpack Show, where we read out error messages from our computers straight to you.
I would actually listen to that under certain circumstances. I mean, like ASMR or something.
Oh.
Like, welcome to the Backpack Show.
I have a 404 error. I have a 1D10T.
Oh, dear. There's a problem between the keyboard and the...
screw loose between the chair and the keyboard. We used to close a lot of troubles like that.
Oh, no. Well, the Backpack Show is a show where we bring you insights about success from unusual places.
Boy, have we got two unusual places today. I always like to say that.
Well, I mean, more than one.
That's right.
So we're going to talk with Carmen Kissel Verrier. She's written a memoir called The Butcher Shop Girl, a memoir for misfits and mavericks, which reminds me of the book you wrote about the freak shall inherit the earth, like your entrepreneurship book. I was like, oh, kindred spirit.
Yeah. I was raised in a slaughterhouse.
Oh. You were not. Carmen was. And Carmen had never left Canada before she left to go become an international exotic dancer.
So like you do.
As one does. It wasn't really an option for me. I liked pizza too much, but that's okay. But there are a lot of other things along the way. She's had quite an adventurous life before settling into being an entrepreneur. And she's got her own agency now. So we're going to talk about her journey and the book, which is very, very exciting.
I was only an exotic dancer in Moncton, New Brunswick, and it just didn't pay. So,
I mean, was it amateur night? People are always cheap on amateur night.
Tuesdays, baby. That's what you get.
And we'll also talk with Ruth Jean-Marie. She founded the August Project to alleviate poverty in underdeveloped countries. So we're going to talk with her about what exactly that looks like and how they fund projects on the ground to improve things for the less fortunate.
And we had such a morning getting that all running, but I think I feel confident. I feel a sense of confidence. Hey, Ruth, by the way, while you're backstage, see if you find just a couple books, get yourself nice and eye level with us, and that'll make you even more smart.
So Carmen is from Canada.
Yeah, Carmen's a Canadian, so you can start your Canadian bologna right away.
We stop it.
That's what they all do. They're Canadian. It's like it's bred into them.
What do you mean they?
Hi, everyone. Tim Kitzer from NBA Jam and NFL Blitz. Welcoming you to The Backpack Show. Your hosts, Chris Brogan, Kerry Gorgone, Boom Shakalaka.
Backpack Show.
Right. What in the earth?
I don't know.
The Sixes look huge and have way more bells and whistles from what I would ever want. Okay, Leslie, that is the most vexing comment yet put up on the Backpack
She's probably
show.
Doing two things at once.
That's a text for another window.
People sometimes do. Thank you, Carol. I've been working on it. Good morning.
Ruth, you look perfect now, by the way.
Hi, John.
So when Ruth comes on later, you're just going to go, man, what a guest. Just by the nature of the good camera.
Yeah, she looks so good.
We'll grab Carmen first because I want to understand, you know, how one goes from butcher shops to exotic dancing. I mean, I could totally
other butcher ever on the show, right? A freelance butcher.
But we've had a couple of exotic
dancers. DJ Cumberbund.
Dancers.
We have.
And he is a freelance butcher, which I didn't even know was a thing.
I thought he was kidding, but then I found out he was serious and I was like, now I have questions. So
then
we have to talk
questions.
About that. So I have questions for Carmen about that as well, because that's where she got her start, in a slaughterhouse.
So let's drag her out here and make some things happen. Hey, Carmen.
Hi. Hey,
how is it being the hottest girl that works in the slaughterhouse?
Oh my goodness, you guys are killing me back here. It's a freelance butcher. I've never heard of such a thing. I want to know about that too.
Right? I guess it's like, so if the, the holidays they're extra busy and you need to take on extra help or something at the butcher shop, like that.
I guess so. Yeah. Jeez.
But I was thinking it was more like, I got this cow needs killing. Can you be here by two?
You know, I need you here right away.
But now you tell me, so it was your mother's slaughterhouse?
Yes, that's right. So my family is big into agriculture, you know, many generations, farms and ranches. And my mother owned a slaughterhouse that her father had helped her with, so to acquire and manage. So when my parents split up when I was about 6 years old, I went to go live with my mother. And my mom was a no guff, no nonsense kind of woman. And the best way for me to get to know her was to work right alongside her in the butcher shop. So I'm a farm kid. So, you know, blood and guts and all that just doesn't faze kids like me. And I learned a lot about physiology, biology in a most up close fashion.
Right? Most of us are like, I have to dissect a frog? Gross.
Yeah.
You must have been like, this is easy. You're probably done before everybody else.
No big deal, for sure. And then all the delicious deli meats and, you know, it's a pretty charming life, actually, I must say.
Well, now growing up in and around Alberta, there's things that you get to do out there that the rest of the world hasn't quite experienced. So one of the things that I was wondering about a little bit was like bush parties.
Yeah.
Do we just take a bunch of 2-4s out to the bushes? Is that what's getting done there or what happened?
2-4s. Look at you. I'm going to make you my honorary Canadian.
Well, thank you.
Absolutely. yeah, bush parties are a thing. I even talk about them in the book. There's another fancy kind of Canadian thing. I don't know if they do it anywhere in the world, but it's called a yucca flux. I talk about that in the book too, where we take big vats of fruit and we soak them in whiskey, vodka, mishmash of all kinds of hard liquors. And then you come and you scoop out the fruit and put it in your cup and well, you get a pretty good buzz with that. So that's called a yucca flux. I've never heard of anybody doing that anywhere
else. Never heard that ever before.
Yes,
we bring you the news here on the Fat Tech Show.
Hot tips, that's right.
The other thing you learn, and you know, a lot of people would know if they're Canadian, is that Alberta is, of course, oil country. And so you learn, you know, maybe there's a little more money in that than there is chopping up cow parts.
Yeah, that's it.
And this kind of sets you on a journey. You want to give us a little preces of the journey?
Yeah, so I didn't get along very well with my mother growing up. I just really, you know, failed to connect with her. She was always a very hardworking, busy woman. So I was very close with my father and his family. So I spent a lot of time at their farm. And I was coming back to them at about 15 after being in my mother's care full time. And I was already quite a badass at that time. They didn't know what to do with me. I'm, you know, pretty hard to contain. And I decide that I'm going to get a job working in the oil field as a single well battery operator. So at 17, 18 years old, I'm doing that. I'm making big money and still living on the farm and then get my own apartment. Then I lose my job because the price of oil fluctuates and I was working for a junior producer that wasn't so stable. Then, you know, I have this apartment, I have a vehicle, I have all of these commitments and I'm not making any money. So at the same time, in the shadow background, I was working as a waitress at our outside the outskirts of our community, which was pretty French Catholic, would never allow an exotic entertainment club in the boundaries of our town. So these types of places were just on the outskirts of town. And I was waitressing there. And I also had quite a lengthy time as a ballet dancer and studying ballet for about 10, 15 years, 12 wow. years maybe. So when I'd see these girls come on, you know, I just thought, well, that's not hard to do. Like, oh my goodness, these guys are so easy to please, you know, all these little hometown boys that I knew. Anyways, this one woman walks in one day and her name is Hunter Holiday in the book. And she is gorgeous. I'm wondering how my boss booked her because we have this really divey exotic entertainer club on the outskirts of town. No good looking dancers that really kind of end up there, except for this beauty just walks in and takes all our breath away. And at this time I had been without a job for about 3 months. And she says, well, you're really beautiful. You know, why don't you do something like this? You know, it sounds like you're a ballet dancer. This should be a slice of cake for you. And I'm like, oh gosh, I could never. Oh my goodness. That's just no way. And, you know, gave her a call a few weeks later and then my life changed forever.
Wow. It's a little different. I presume you don't do as many pliés when you're working on.
I mean, maybe you do more. I don't know.
No. I liken it to like Cirque du Soleil. So back then in the late 90s, early 2000s, exotic entertainers in Canada, you know, put on a show. They would spend thousands of dollars on their costumes and they would travel around as if you made it to feature entertainment status. And you get booked at all the best clubs and get all the best perks, but you had to put on a show. So lots of pole acrobatics, lots of flexibility, similar to what you would see at Cirque du Soleil, maybe not with missing the vertebrae that they're missing in their spines, but very close to it. So
when do you take the show on the road? Because you had never left Canada before, right? Before you got an offer to be an international exotic dancer.
Yes, that's right. So going to Bolivia, obviously, was, you know, I was 19. I got suckered into this from an agent from Vancouver who's like, oh, yeah, we need young girls. They can't get enough Canadian and American girls. So want to open this brand new club that's there. And I mean, I was hungry to travel. I hadn't really been anywhere. And I said, sure, sounds great. Let's give it a try. So end up going down there and find myself into this probably very dicey, sketchy cartel family kind of action. And I'm just starting to piece together that this business has all of these sideline criminal activities, you know, racketeering, things like that. Cash-based businesses are perfect for money laundering. You know, I didn't know any of those things. I'm 19 and I'm just looking to go on an adventure. So I kind of thought, I can't believe I'm telling you guys this, but I thought that Santa Cruz, you know, sounded like an oceanfront paradise. It, you know, wasn't until I got there really that I realized it was completely landlocked and I'm in way over my head and I'm getting into about to be in some serious danger that I don't even recognize until the love interest of the book comes along just completely by fluke, completely by fate. And he's an American U.S. customs agent, not quite a DEA agent, but they work very closely with drug enforcement agents to prevent large scale drugs.
Carol amounts from video clips coming.
Yeah, right. Hey, Carol, no. Everybody, we got to tell Carol it's like, you know, 22 years ago that this book ended, that my life ended.
But it is you. So we're talking about all this like it's a work of fiction. This is your memoir.
It's a real life story. Absolutely. Nothing in it is fabricated. So there's two things that you got to have with a memoir. One, it has to be an interesting story. And the other, it has to be true. So if you can deliver on those two things, you'll be good to go.
So your Prince Charming finds you dancing on a pole in Bolivia, landlocked Bolivia.
Yeah, he's kind of like, wow, there's American and Canadian girls here. I'm really shocked by that. And I got to know him a little bit. And he kind of took me around the city, spoke a little bit of Spanish, and he was just really nice looking guy. And he seemed very comfortable. And I was able to speak English with him because not everybody, hardly anybody spoke English there. Even our boss or our house mom or whatever she was, the club owner, Elena, she spoke kind of broken English too. So I was pretty lonely after about 4 or 5 days of being there and not having too many people to talk to. A lot of people think that exotic entertainers are just best pals with other dancers. And that's really not the case. They're quite competitive with each other. And you have to spend a serious amount of time with each other to start opening up because there's lots of trade secrets involved and, you know, good agents that you want to keep under wraps that book you for the best job. So it's a bit of a secret world there too. So I didn't really feel like I could hang out with them. One left even after 2 days. She realized that it wasn't necessarily the job danger that scared her, it was the lack of money we were making. So the currency was what really got me, you know. That's when I started to learn about currency. So the Boliviano is valued less than the Mexican peso.
Ooh.
So yeah, you know what I'm saying. So it took us about 3 days to realize that what looked like massive amounts of money coming at us was really translating into not very much at all. And then there's this danger element. So,
yeah, I mean, when you frame it as exotic dancer goes to Bolivia, it sounds pretty hot until you realize you're making like $31.
That's it, right? Yeah.
So where does it go from here? I didn't read your book. Do we move into, you found a better place to do your dancing, or do you take all of this skill, bring it back to Canada and say, now I'm going to run the best life I've ever had in my life?
Yeah, so at that time, I was able to escape out of Bolivia with my family's help. I had been keeping secret what I was doing from them for quite some time. So that's largely how they found out, was a phone call in the middle of the night. Hey, I'm in trouble. I'm in South America, and I need your help to get home. So quite a rude awakening. My family's absolutely wonderful. I want you to picture the sweetest, most charming set of grandparents. My grandmother is a school teacher at a Catholic school. My grandfather is a rancher, and I'm very, very close with them. So they're my first call when I'm in trouble. And my grandma, you know, without any questions asked, just found the money to buy these very expensive last minute flights from South America, brought me back home to Edmonton. Then I had to come face the music and pay them back and explain what the heck I was doing here. And I, you know, my ruse has been uncovered. I'm found out. And at that point, I'm still 19. So I'm like, you know what? I've had a taste of this big money. Maybe this job went sour, but I'm gonna do me. And thank you so much for helping me. You probably won't see me for a little while because I'm going to probably get right back to what I was doing, but in a smarter fashion. So that ended up happening.
I was thinking you learned some stuff about entrepreneurship.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, I kind of grew up with entrepreneurship. Like everybody in my family was a business owner. So at that point, I start to move out east. I think, oh no, I need to add some distance between me and my family, their disappointment, their obvious disappointment in me, and head out east. Maybe go see what it's like in Ontario. And then we arrive in Toronto. And that's when it's, you know, everything kind of changes. Toronto is like the New York City of Canada, you know, obviously way smaller, but that same type of feel where big ideas and cultural explosions happen together. And I was so ready for it. I couldn't wait to get right in there. Then we end up down in Niagara Falls. And I speak a lot about Toronto and Niagara Falls in my book. And in Niagara Falls, we start to realize that we're making American currency because the drinking age in Ontario is 19 and it's 21 in New York State. So obviously a lot of them young guys are heading over the border, and a lot of athletes and people who don't want to be found, right? They're heading over as well to Niagara Falls to spend their American money there. So we start making a lot of money there. Then a good friend I meet there says that she's moving to Texas, and she's got a really lucrative line at a really great club somewhere in Houston, Texas. And she says, I'm going to go get settled there first. And then if it's as good as it looks, then I'm going to bring you down too. So she calls me up 4 days later, you know, next flight, Bush International, I'm there. And at that time, I'm starting to develop a relationship with the love interest of the man who helped rescue me from Bolivia. He lives in Florida. So we kind of pick up where we left off, and we end up having a 2-year romance, and I'm flying in between Texas and Florida. So in Florida, I'm able to keep my life my own. I'm just a regular girl, a regular girlfriend, and you know, I'd head back to Texas to work. And then I started to learn a lot about, you know, what to do with money, and you know, I didn't know anything. I'm 20 and 21 at this point, so I'm learning how to navigate that world and get that money back to Canada. And it's kind of, I talk about it in the book as well, that you don't even really realize that you're money laundering when you're doing it, I guess, if you don't really know a lot about it, right? So, and all along there, before reaching the United States, I had spent a lot of time with some pretty tough girls in our industry in Western Canada that are largely affiliated with the Hells Angels and whatnot. And they were my guides. They were my protectors, and they were like my big sisters. And I speak a lot about them in the book, Shay and Jolene, they're characters you just don't want to miss. So
Carmen, people want to know, what are you doing now? What's the situation now? Are you still out there shining a bunch of metal?
No, so it's a bit of a, yeah, it's been 22 years since I said goodbye to that world, and I'm 42 now. So I'm married, I have 2 kids, and I just wrote this book. So when I was 21 years old, I you know, said goodbye to Alexa, my stage name, and I never wanted to talk about her again. I never wanted to pull her out of the closet ever again. I hoped nobody would know about her and that time in my life. And as I approached my 40s, with a lot of goading and, you know, from my friends and family, you should tell your story. You've got a really neat story. It's so fascinating. We love hearing about it when you'll rarely open up and talk about it. So I kind of thought, you know, I've always been a freelance writer. Used to be a columnist for our local newspaper and an article contributor monthly to various energy sector magazines, talking about business in the oil and gas industry. So I kind of thought, yeah, I could try my hand at writing a memoir. And it took me 3 years, put it down on paper, published it right away with Freezen Press Canada in November. And it's been selling like hotcakes ever since, because people just can't believe that this is a true story. So it's a true story. It's pretty fascinating. And I feel like I'm just not ashamed of it anymore. So I feel like it's a part of what made me me. And I had learned a lot about people, how to cultivate empathy, how to really put yourself in their shoes with the type of background that I had. So that framed my business initiatives moving forward. So now I'm a boutique branding agency owner, and we help all newcomers to business from logo to launching their websites, creating promotional materials, you know, solving minor PR problems, etc. So I feel like I reinvented myself in 22 years. Anybody can do it. So a large part of my message in the Butcher Shop Girl is that it doesn't matter where you come from. It doesn't matter what you're not proud of. You can always start here. You can always start now. And you can change your narrative, just like big corporations and athletes and any, you know, influencers, anybody who gets into trouble can certainly pivot and adapt. And you can too. So just embrace your shame, make friends with your regret, and you'd be surprised how untouchable you feel afterwards.
Carmen Kissel-Verrier, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing this with us. This is so great. I appreciate it. Stick around if you can. We usually do a little bit of a panel at the very end. So stick around.
Sure. We'll see what we can get done. Thank you so much.
Thank you for being here. Well, so a lot there. I usually like to do my ads at the beginning because I don't want you all to run away and go pee or nothing like that. You've got to see Ruth Jean-Marie.
Too
We've
fast.
Got so much. So quick, run pee. We're sponsored by PubSite. PubSite is a site for authors. Authors, if you've built that incredible book that you need to build, this is the fastest, easiest way to throw up an author website. A couple hours, you're done. You've got a killer site. It's free for 14 days, and after that, $19.99 US dollars a month.
Not Bolivian.
It's not. We don't pay this in Bolivianos or whatever they were called. So that's how that works. You want some sausage? We've got some sausage. We are sponsored by Johnsonville for a little while longer. We're going to have our next Johnsonville Appreciation Day in a couple of weeks. So if you want Carrie to send you sausage, and you can send us a video, carrie@chrisbrogan.com. That's free sausage, baby. Meat for free. All right. We're sponsored by, you know, a butcher would know that that's, you know, value. seebrogan.me/StreamYard. You can make your own show just like this one, right, Carrie?
Get your own former international exotic dancer.
Exactly. We have a podcast live and kicking. It is sponsored on castos.com. If you want us in your ear while you're taking Max for a walk, just stick your favorite podcast app on and go find the Backpack Show. We're there. We're there. Five
Can
or
we
six
just
episodes.
Talk about how of all the people I would have expected to ask for videos of Carmen's
would not have been Carol.
I did not think it would be Carol Alaloof.
There you go. Like,
wanting those videos.
Hey, you know, she appreciates a good Canadian dancer just like the rest of us.
I guess so.
Linda is here. Linda says a reinvention is good. Changing one's narrative is good. We are who we are. No shame. Love Linda for that. We're going to grab Ruth Jean-Marie. We have so much to ask her, and she has gone through every technical hurdle she could ever go through. But I think
let's ready? See how it goes.
Fingers crossed. We got you, Ruth.
I'm here, laughing in color. Good morning.
Yay! Ruth Jean-Marie. Thank you for joining us today.
No problem. I'm a little sad that I had to go after Carmen. So let's hope that I'm
well. I thought you were raised on a farm and that you went and did exotic dancing somewhere else.
The farmlands of Brooklyn, New York. Yeah,
that's right. You know, you go down to Williamsburg where there's those artisan butchers, and then, you know, you have to go down to, you know, Third Avenue or so, and you could dance. I don't know. It's
Let me take some notes. I think I need to add some color to my biography once I write one. So autobiography.
Well, when you're ready to write your memoir, definitely.
Website.
Yeah. Get a website for your book. Get that memoir going. But let's talk about the August Project. What brought you around to founding it?
I think similar to Carmen, I didn't have a job. Like, I did all the right things, quote unquote, what society tells you to do. Went to college, went to grad school, graduated with a degree in global affairs, concentration in human rights and international law, planned to save the world, but nobody hired me.
They didn't want to save the world.
Right?
The world's fine.
You know, just let me be your hero. Cue Enrique Iglesias. But I think it wasn't until after grad school where I realized how elitist the global affairs field is. Like, you would think that human rights is a space where, like, the safe for hippies and the folks that want to do good, but it was just as elitist as any other field. And I didn't have the network necessary to, you know, provide for myself, you know, eat every day. So after a brief stint of major depression, I ended up with a job at the Department of Health. But before that, I went on a trip to Martinique, and Martinique was also colonized by the French the same way Haiti was. So I served as the primary interpreter for my friends while I was there. And my friend just kind of said offhand, like, hey, you should do something about this, like interpreting for tourists or things of that nature. From there, and there was a series of other, like, not necessarily connected events that kind of just started a project. It was just a passion project. I wanted to do something for social media. So I interviewed Haitians that grew up in New York. If you grew up in New York in the 80s and 90s, you know, it's kind of difficult for the Haitians and people who immigrated for, from Africa as well. We had the same insults. So those are my kin because of that. So I did this project and I took all their narratives and the pictures came out great. So instead of social media, I did a photo gallery and then we raised $1,000. I was like, oh, I can send that to Haiti. And then those two ideas kind of melded. And I was like, oh, I can continue to do something like this in which I raise funds for the neighborhood that my mom is from called Léogâne, La Cule, in Haiti. And then from there, it just became bigger and bigger. And I started to identify like the gaps and be like the fact that it's difficult to get into. And then it became a consulting firm and a not-for-profit in which we like raise money for projects on the ground in Haiti.
Yeah. You have been doing a whole bunch of things. Like you said, there's a bit of hustle that comes when you realize, oh, crap, I'm not getting the jobs I want. I guess I'm going to go after and make some jobs. So in the process, you know, you started doing all kinds of things in all directions, Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. You went and then start this, you know, when you start into your project about working on the August project, though, part of what you decide to do is, I think I'll see if I can convince Nike that they want to make a special shoe for Haiti. I don't get how that happens. Like, because I got to imagine that every single day someone comes up to Nike and says, I got a great idea for a shoe. It's going to look like French fries because French fries are awesome. And then they just hang up the phone. How did, like, what was this like? What was the call like? How did you make this happen?
I have this thing where, like, you think your life is going to go perfectly and it's supposed to be linear after you do X, Y, and Z and then everything. You become rich and, you know, you forget about the actual details in between. And Nike is one of those things where there was a call for creatives like 30 minutes before midnight. I was like, I'm not going to get this shit, but fuck it. Let me try so that I can talk shit about another failed attempt. I was like, I want to be able to tell people I tried and it doesn't work. But, like, so I... because at the moment, my passion was already Haitian. So everything I did was made with Haiti in mind. So the question was actually, like, what makes your community special? And if you know anything about Brooklyn, like, we have a large population of Haitians. Like, after, in the 90s, we were the second largest population after the capital of Haiti. Like, with including the city, like, the cities that exist in Haiti. So I just discussed how... the Haitian population in Brooklyn just brings something so special. Like, we have our own parades, we have our own neighborhoods, there are schools named after our revolutionaries, there are elected officials that are from there or their parents are from there. So I just discussed that and I like press submit and I like threw my phone and I went to sleep. And I'm just like, and I got depressed about having convinced myself that they would never go for like the value or worthiness of like my people or where I'm from. I think a little bit over 30 individuals across the country, I was chosen. And even after that, I still was like, okay, only my family and friends are going to buy this sneaker. Let me just like send some text messages and send some Instagram DMs and let's see what happens. And in 4 days, I sold about 600 pairs of sneakers. They're sold out. And it's been a little bit over a year and I'm still getting accosted about when they're going to come out again. So if Nike is listening, I need them to like reinvest because
get them out there.
Yeah.
Make
that's
more.
That's big. So
yeah, it was an amazing experience.
This project, besides, you know, bullying Nike into making shoes for, you know, to celebrate Haiti, what do you want people to do? What does the August Project have to do for the world?
I want the August Project to motivate others to understand that the people in underdeveloped countries have the answers to their solutions. A lot of the obstacles that they face are not ones that they created. It's a result of historical oppression. It's a result of corruption in global organizations and in their own government. But the ideas, the talent, the beauty, the worthiness, the dignity will come from them. So when I say I want to save the world, obviously I have no intention to. It seems like a heavy job, a heavy lift. And I like to go on vacation and, you know, things like that. But I do want the August Project to just serve as a support. So that's why we so often ask them, like, what do you want to do? Could get together with the community and tell me what the issues are. How do you want to solve them? Because we can have these lofty ideas about like introducing technology, but because we have blind spots, we don't really have to worry about electricity or generators. The ideas we come up with are so soaked in privilege that they can never work. And then when they don't work, because there's this like historical narrative about people in underdeveloped countries not having the ability to provide for themselves, we can blame them and everyone will believe us. And we just kind of move on, right? Because the effort is enough. So I want the August Project to teach people that the effort is not enough. If you are going to make the effort, it needs to be informed. And it needs to be done with the understanding that the people that you're seeking to help are the ones that are going to help themselves. You just serve as like a background support, tech support.
Okay. Bob Collins is one of our Backpack Show community members, regular to the show. He wants to know, what was the moment you had or experienced where you knew that you were building something special with real momentum?
I think it was a few moments, right? Because there are ebbs and flows where like you do something really great and then afterward you kind of convince yourself that was a fluke, and then you do something really great again and you're like, oh, you ain't shit. So I think two of the major moments I think was the Nike situation. Because it ended up being super international. Like someone mentioned, there's a large population in Montreal. So there were Canadians that were hitting me up. There were Haitians in Haiti that were hitting me up. And there were just a lot of people that were reaching out to say how much it meant to them to see Haiti shown the way it was in the mainstream. So there's a lot of, unfortunately, there is value in associating yourself with major players. And it was a great experience and I love it. I would love to do it again with Nike. But that association with Nike gave us a lot of legitimacy and it inspired a lot of people that I didn't realize it was going to. So like a lot of the messages I got were so heartfelt that I couldn't convince myself I wasn't doing anything meaningful anymore. It's like people like, oh my God, just because of you, I feel like I can go for my dreams and I can do this and all these other things. I'm just like, oh wow, like I've had impact on people. So that created a lot of momentum, increased the amount of people that were paying attention to the work that we were doing already. And then just continuing to like make sure, yeah, I love this scroll of mine. just continuing to do that work and adding the strategic partnerships to it.
And right? On top of everything else, it was a really nice looking sneaker. Like I want one now.
I couldn't even get a pair for my mother. I was waiting for payday on Friday and they sold that on Tuesday. Oof. So, and they're super comfortable. I love my pair. But I think that was one of the major moments.
You got one and then you're like, sorry, mom, you can't have one. That had to piss her off.
We were the same size though. So she borrowed mine and went back to Haiti for like 3 months with them. I don't know if I'm going to see them again.
I want to go back and put a little yellow highlighter on something you said, because it reminded me of a conversation I had with a billionaire, Manoj Bhargava, who invented 5-Hour Energy, amongst other things. And he took a lot of his money to help India because India has a lot of poverty challenges itself. One of the things he said, sort of off record, was that, and I say that because I can't remember if it was off record or not, but he said, you know, a lot of the times when people come and try to save India, they presume running water. They presume steady state power. They presume all this stuff that you would imagine living in this country that we live in while we're coming up with these ideas. So you said that as well. I'm curious to know, when you kind of help people understand how their solutions aren't going to work and all that sort of thing, how does that work? Like how does the sit down in that meeting set, you know, like what does that feel like?
It feels great. I think when you learn about human rights, you realize that they're not universal, even though there is a universal declaration of human rights. But when you see which countries privilege certain things, you realize that different people have different values. So while we, like more Western countries, would be like, oh, philosophy, the ability to think freely and interact and interchange, a lot of other countries are just kind of like, I want to eat every day. And that's what I can do. Like that's their luxury, right? So I think when I'm sitting down and having these conversations, there's been so much conversation already around like white privilege or male privilege and straight privilege and all these other things that there's already a bedrock of understanding. And I'm often speaking to other Haitians. So I'm just identifying like their privilege. Like you were raised in a developed country and this is how it shows when you're doing this. When you're sending remittances back or you're sending clothes back, you're undoing the work that people are doing there already. Like there are tailors in Haiti that don't have a job anymore because you keep sending your old clothes back. There's a sustainability issue because you're like just saying like this is enough. So it feels great. It feels empowering. Sometimes it feels difficult because because it's my field, you assume that it's obvious knowledge and it's not. So sometimes it's you saying the same thing over and over and over again. But I feel like a lot of people have been receptive because there's already been this social justice movement to say, like, these are your blind spots, these are your privilege. And I can just like build upon that, especially with groups that are already underprivileged. It's kind of like, oh, I guess I am doing that. I am going to a country and just handing out money and then leaving without creating like some actual infrastructure around access to money. So it's interesting. It's a good place to be, I would say. Yeah.
What kind of projects are happening on the ground there now? Like what's executing over there right now? Or are you in between the projects or what's happening?
So both. So we were supposed to launch 3 major projects in 2020. Did not happen. None of it happened. We were supposed to, the gallery project that I mentioned earlier, I want to build it out into a coffee table book. I think photos, especially of just regular everyday life, has the value of like humanizing groups of people. So I was like, I did it in New York and I did it in Boston, and we got great reception. Let me do it in Haiti, obviously, because that's obvious. And just really identify the niches that exist there, the LGBTQ community, the merchants, the people in government. Wasn't able to travel in 2020. We were supposed to start our literacy circle in 2020, wasn't able to travel. We were supposed to start our innovation workshops, in which it's just like basically a brainstorming group where we provide food, but we get to be the fly on the wall of their conversations and see what they wanted to do and how they sought to solve their problems. Didn't happen. So all of the things, all the major things that we wanted to happen didn't. But right now we're in the throes of raising money for an economy challenge. So we're investing in 3 entrepreneurs. We're partnered with the Haitian American Caucus and Hope for Haiti to raise up to $18,000 to give in, to invest in entrepreneurs in Haiti. And 100% of the money goes to them and their ideas and their pitches. So the pitch competition is April 24th. It'll be live on Facebook. They'll be able, everything that we believe in as an organization is happening through this project. So I'm grateful to be able to be in partnership with those organizations and give away some money. not even in giving away, you're investing in their ideas and thoughts. So
you didn't explain to us earlier that one of your side hustles is evidently modeling. Holy cannoli here. You have quite an interesting and engaged Instagram. There's a lot.
Do I have to yellow card you?
You don't have to yellow card me. All I said is, you know.
I'm going
to
do it.
Boom shakalaka. Yellow card, Brogan. And Brogan is going down like a bag of hammers tonight.
I like that one. Well, every time. No. You got to say something about like how they look. You don't.
You know, I don't think it's. I don't know.
We had Horacio Garcia Rojas on. He was very nice to look at. Did I mention it? No.
I did.
Well, that's different. You were having a good romance.
He's good looking. What can you say? With him. He's a beautiful Mexican comedy horror actor. What do? You gotta flirt with him. All right, I'm grabbing Carmen.
Look him up, actually.
I'll show you.
He's wonderful. He's a Mexico City actor. He's in the Netflix series Diablero.
Get on your Netflix. Watch Diablero. You'll have a lot of fun.
I've been looking for the watch anyway, but yeah. But that picture was like my friend's a photographer. So I think we help each other out sometimes. But if you're looking for a motto, I'm always down for another side hustle.
There you go. I like it. Well, I'm grabbing Carmen back. We're going to have a little bit of a panel.
Nice.
There we go. Maybe you should look into CNN Heroes. There you go. Another spot to go.
Bob says he didn't deserve the yellow card. Thank you. Agree to disagree, Bob, but it's my show, so.
I just said, hey, maybe you say make a model. Carmen, you're here. What, you saw that picture. What would you think?
She's pretty. Pretty aces, yeah.
Right back at you, Carmen.
There's a certain modeling verve to these pictures, though. Excuse me. No one poses like that normally in their idiot Instagram photos.
Can you recreate that, Chris? I want to see your Instagram like getting a lot better after this.
I would like you to too, actually.
Yeah, right? Let's go. Let's get somebody to take those pictures. Like, we'll pay your kids.
You know, okay.
I'll show you.
Yeah, yeah.
Let me go where this could go, which is to say that sometimes ladies don't get the credit they deserve for the skill and the wisdom that they bring because they're also attractive. And so then people put the wrong energy in the wrong places. Mm-hmm. I wonder if either of you have experienced that before professionally.
Recently?
Yeah, I think that's called pretty privilege. It's a thing, yeah. But I mean, Ruth, I mean, you're a pretty good looking girl too. I can imagine you've experienced some of that as well.
I remember representing someone, and I'm a lawyer, and in court, he was sitting next to me to go over an agreement. He said, "Oh, that's right, your council. That's cute. I forgot."
That's cute. Cute. Yeah.
I cleaned the clock.
Yeah.
I don't think I'd ever threaten a lawyer with anything like that.
Yeah, no kidding. I'm happy you told me that, Carrie. I didn't know you were a lawyer too.
Yep, I don't practice now, but surprisingly not as fulfilling as the creative work I'm doing. Somehow.
Yeah.
Bunces, I pose that way all the time, especially when I'm grilling and doing laundry.
He does, though. Look at his picture right there. Like, he's doing the Walt Disney pose and stuff. He does pose.
Well, that's him at the, White House taking a press secretary commentary. So,
yeah.
It's definitely not. All right. Back to, like, let's pretend we have a show for a minute. Let's ask one question, which is, if you were telling somebody who feels like they're not good enough, they don't deserve it. You both said, so Ruth talked about depression. Ruth talked about what it's like to get slammed a bunch of times. Carmen, you talked about having a past that, you know, you had to really come to terms with. Let's talk about that. Like, you know, what do you do to, you're talking to a room full of young ladies and you want to tell them something about this. I'll start with Ruth.
I would say keep going. I don't, there's not really a moment where like you get over sadness, like, but understanding how life works, it like circular, not linear, helps a lot. Tracy Ellis Ross talked about, it's an Instagram video, but it helped a lot when I was sadder. It was just like, identify the next implicated moment. Like, it doesn't have to be, oh, where am I going to be at 40, or where am I going to be at 50, where am I going to be at 35? Like, we try to have all these major milestones. Like, I'm 30. I'm actually 31. Sorry, I like to round before someone says I lied about my
age. Don't lie, Ruth.
But like, you're fed all these things about what's supposed to happen at each point of your life, but that's not the way life goes. So like, ground yourself in reality and just identify the next implicated moment. Today, I'm going to get 6 emails out. And that's the accomplishment for the day. Everything isn't these huge obstacles you overcome. So you just keep going and you just do the next implicated thing, the next implicated thing. And when the joy comes, ride it. And when the sadness comes, experience it. But things will work out.
Carmen.
Yes, I agree with Jean. With Ruth, you have to sit with your feelings. That's important. So my biggest tip, we talk a lot about confidence and cultivating real confidence, but really the best way to get it is to accept your flaws. As soon as you accept your flaws, nobody can use them against you. And it's incredibly empowering. So George Martin says that quote, you know, once you accept your flaws, no one can weaponize them against you. I really, really believe that's true, because you become so untouchable. There's nothing that anybody can say to you once you've sat with your own shame and your own regret. And we all have it. We all have things that we're not proud of. So I feel like encouraging people to embrace themselves fully and completely by sitting with that discomfort. Sit with that discomfort. It'll pass. It's just your ego trying to push you out of the way so that it can take center stage. But if you just grab control of your own ego, man, there's nothing you can do. You can't do afterwards. So,
I love it. Yeah. Absolutely. Agree.
Into it. Confidence, says Linda, isn't knowing if people will like you or your work. It's knowing you'll be okay if they don't.
Absolutely. Good one.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, you're not going to be everybody's cup of tea, and that's fine. You really can't be.
Yeah.
So.
Or what other people think of you is none of your business. One of my faves.
Yeah. Take hold of it. Who you are and what you have. This is mine. Like, even y'all are like talking about my looks now, but I had braces. I had a bang for a long time because I didn't like my forehead. Like, there was like a lot going into this. And one day I really had to be like, you know what? If I'm ugly, it's my ugly. It belongs to me. And like, I have ownership of everything that I was. And there's no one else in the world that has every single thing that I have overlapping. Like, even my brother and my sister, they don't look like me. They're not my age. They can't offer what I offer. And that has helped a lot in terms of confidence. And then, you know, I took the braces off and things got better.
There we go. It gets better. Like those videos. Oh,
my brother was like a bronze god in high school, like a lifeguard with blonde hair. And like, he was basically perfect. And I had glasses and was like all messed up and pasty faced. I was like really bookish. And so now he's lost all his hair. And I'm like, that's what's up.
It's a big trade. Hey, guess what time it is?
Oh, and here's our person of the day. Kaboom!
You can't not give it to Linda Lopecki. I mean, look at that. There's nothing better.
Yay.
That's it. It's covered. You're handled. And then Deanna came. Hi, Deanna. We should start the show over now that you're here. Glad to have you here. I don't know what you keep doing, getting clients at this time of day. You should know at this point, it's not the way to go. Right. Listen, we have one last question we ask every single guest that's ever been on the show. So people like Sir Mix-a-Lot, people like Ariel Helvetica, our burlesque friend, all of the people that we've had on the show, Sister Anne Flanagan from the Daughters of St. Paul, have all answered one important question. What goes in your backpack? And this question involves the idea of either something physical, something metaphorical. So freelance butcher DJ Cummerbund, when asked what goes in your backpack, said what?
An extra set of teeth.
You know, because you never know when you're going to need an extra set of teeth. Horacio Garcia Rojas said about a metaphorical thing.
Pride. Like pride in where you come from.
Like Alberta. Like, someone out there has to have Alberta pride.
If only there was someone watching.
And good vibes. I like good vibes. So yeah, Deanna says do over. Okay, we'll start again.
Yeah, well, give me a minute. Oh, there it is. I was looking for this one.
Yes, thank you. Canadian pride. So Carmen Kissel-Verrier, what goes in the backpack?
So it's just one thing?
Just one. No weird just framework. One thing. No collection of the fridge.
You know, honestly, I would have to pick my husband. He's got to go in there. He's like my favorite person. We spend so much time together. He just gets me. But if it was two things, it would be my husband plus tweezers.
Oh, okay. Okay. You never know when you need some tweezers.
It's still Bob's favorite.
That's a great answer. It's a weird
answer. I mean, you haven't heard both their answers yet, so wait. You may be
all right, well, Kate had a meeting, and it was a spiritual one, so I guess we can accept that answer, Kate.
Okay,
so
Colgan. Oh, okay, thank you.
Yeah. Welcome.
Well, she said good morning, and we're minutes from ending, and I was just like, what, Kate?
Yeah, but she was doing very important work. All right, Ruth, it's your turn, Ruth Jean-Marie. What goes in the backpack?
Jeez, I have a few things also, but I'll stay within the rules, even though I don't like rules or frameworks, pre-existing frameworks. I'm going to say a bomb-ass playlist, just one that will get you, like, pick you up and or sometimes let you ride that wave of whatever you're feeling, so a good playlist.
He has a really good playlist. Yes. It makes me wonder what hers is, though, but I feel like I would probably go with his. So,
are Nancy the tweezers? From Scotland says you're both very interesting.
Deanna asks, are the tweezers for chin hair?
Yeah, I'm in my 40s. Like, you get one in there and you're like, oh, how did I not see this? How long have I been walking around with that?
That's one great thing about travel is travel not being a thing. You're not under those horrible airplane lights anymore. So
yeah, that's it.
No one's going to notice.
We're all going
to
be safe.
Right. I just get one also, actually, to be honest. So I'm just like, ah.
Right?
Yeah. I'm starting to get old Russian man hairs. So and I'm not Russian, but I get them like on the outsides of my ear, like I'm trying to become a werewolf.
Are you Irish?
I'm Irish. I hope so. All right. Listen, there's one thing I was thinking about this whole time. My grandmother was born and raised up in the New Brunswick part of Canada and then came down to the United States at an early age. So I am, you know, genetically, at least some of my blood is from the Canadian side. And one thing my grandmother would have said about strip clubs, especially the ones that they had out in New Brunswick and Montreal area, is that if you ever get up on that pole, make sure you